The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. All discussion is limited to publicly available information and should not be interpreted as legal, professional, or financial advice. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license nor provide any financial services. Before making investment decisions, you should obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor.
Hello, my name's James Wrigley. I'm a financial advisor and one of the principals of Melbourne-based financial planning firm First Financial. I've been a long-term listener and contributor to the Ensemble Group and podcast, picking up some amazing nuggets of gold over the years. And through this podcast and the people that I'm able to speak to and interview, hopefully I can continue to deliver some of those nuggets of gold to you.
Introducing Macquarie ETFs. Macquarie's active ETFs now give you easier access to the global active investment expertise and strategies that were previously only available as traditional unlisted managed funds. Benefit from the transparency and convenience of an ETF structure underpinned by the global investment expertise of Macquarie's fund managers, which offer you additional options for portfolio diversification and the potential for index outperformance. Discover everyday access to active investments with Macquarie. Visit etf.macquarie.com to find out more.
Hello, welcome back to the podcast. I've got the pleasure of speaking with Kira Brown today, Kira from FS Recruitment Solutions. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Really pleased to be here.
As we're saying just before we press record, a podcast with someone kind of around recruitment and hiring people in financial advice and so forth. I thought it was a little while since I'd done one of those, and so hence here we are. Maybe Kira, can you just spend a minute or two kind of introducing yourself? We've never spoken before either, so it's good to just know where you're at and what you're up to.
I've been recruiting purely in the financial planning industry. That was the first job that I fell into when I moved to Australia. About 19 years now in financial planning recruitment. And 14 years of that has been running my own recruitment agency. It's been me, just little old me by myself for a long time until probably about 12 months ago when I got my full-time assistant, Liz. I call her my assistant, but she manages me and she's absolutely exceptional. And business has never been any better. It's fantastic. The majority of the firms that I recruit for are private practices. So even back in the bank heydays, I never really did much recruitment for the banks at all. I don't do industry funds. I see a lot of candidates coming out of there, but don't tend to recruit in there. So anything from a First Financial, a Cambo, which I've put probably two-thirds of the staff of a Cambo in the actual office, and that kind of size business to your private practices that probably only have, you know, three or four staff members and anything in between. GMs to CSOs.
Perfect. And business must be going well for you if you're, you know, 14 years in and you've just, you know, in the last year or so hired someone to work with you. Business must be as good as it's ever been.
It is. It's great. Yeah. But I could have used her probably about 10 years ago. It's just always that reluctance when you're self-employed, you know. Oh, really? Will it always be this good? Well, you know, take it quite seriously when you hire someone. I convince people to hire people every day of the week. When it comes to me doing it, I really wanted to make sure that I could give someone that security. And now I really do wish I'd have done it a decade ago because she's been a great resource.
It's funny you say that. I get the opportunity to talk to a lot of people in financial advice hosting this podcast, and a lot of them are just going out on their own, or they've been, you know, on their own for the last year or two, and they all talk about that struggle to say, when can I afford this person? When do I really need them?
Yep.
And then they all say, I wish I had have done this earlier. Every single person without fail says, I wish I had have done this earlier.
Absolutely. Bite off more than you can chew and just chew.
That's it. I suppose if you've got to feed yourself and enough to pay the other person, then you'll do what you need to do.
Maybe
if we start by giving us kind of a bit of a lay of the land in financial advice recruitment. So if we kind of go back a while, and I'm not on the recruitment side, you are, but there's been a whole host of things in financial advice over the years. Like if we go back to the kind of all the banking troubles, they soaked up all the paraplanners, then...
We had NAB had a pool of 35 paraplanners. CBA had a pool of, you know, 30-odd paraplanners at one time.
Salaries went through the roof for paraplanners. Absolutely. And that kind of all died down.
Yeah.
No one had professional year. And there's been this couple of years period where it was probably more difficult than it was to get advisors. COVID seen a bit of an explosion of people seeking advice. So where are we at
There's been so many epic changes. Well, the Royal Commission, I mean, what that concluded in, was it 2019? Basically, the Royal Commission and the introduction of the professional year has made my life so much more difficult in terms of now the knock-on effect of that is finding a certain demographic of advisors. So those advisors who back in 2019 were probably paraplanners, having done 3 or 4 years of paraplanning or associate type work that really should have been stepping up into a junior advisor role, it didn't happen. Because when the professional year came in, businesses didn't know what to do. It wasn't rolled out very well. There wasn't a lot of education around that. And businesses were really frightened to take that commitment on, which meant that it was the professional year was going around for probably about 2 years before anybody actually started doing it. And then when they did, that slowed the process down. You've got big businesses like First Financial and Shadforth and places like that that may say, okay, well, of all the associates, we're only going to put one or two through every year. And what that does is creates a real shortage in the market where we should have a big group of male and female candidates that are probably in their early 30s that should probably have 3 years or so financial planning experience, and they just don't because that's the demographic that we're missing. So we've got a lot of people that are just finishing the professional year now with not very much experience, and then we've got the more mature advisors that got in before that happened, and there's a big shortage in the market. When someone comes to me and says, oh, I want an advisor with, you know, 3 to 4 years experience, I say, geez, that's a really tough call. That's difficult, that one.
And that's going to be with us.
Forever,
because you're going to have this. If someone's coming to you today saying, I want someone with 3 or 4 years experience, and then in a few years' time, they come into you saying, oh, I'd like someone with 10 years experience, for example. Yep. And there's always going to be this chunk of time in the middle there that's missing, isn't it?
That's exactly right. It really is. Yeah, it's been one of the biggest issues that we've had. And unfairly, a lot of businesses do come to us recruiters with an idea of a certain demographic in mind, not that they should. But you know, they do, and we can't always find it, and it's just not available, and it's a real shame.
Yeah. What about hiring in other areas? Like we've had periods of time in our business where it's been really difficult to find associate advisors, for example.
Yeah.
Like you put up a job ad, you get heaps of people applying, but really there's one or two people that might actually be, you know, good enough that you'd interview them in the first place, let alone offer someone a job. Like, is it just for advisors?
Quality is
tough, or is it everywhere?
I will find recruiters, specialised recruiters will always find more quality candidates than a business will. The reason for that is when you're advertising with your own brand, there's always going to be preconceived ideas. Oh, that business is too big. Oh, that business isn't big enough. Oh, I don't want to be one of however many AAs. And whatever those preconceived ideas are will often put some candidates off. Whereas when a recruiter advertises something a little bit more generic, or maybe like myself when I'm working on 5 AA roles on any given day and I have 5 ads, they'll just come to me to have a chat. And I may be able to get over those preconceived ideas by saying, just because you've had a bad experience in one big firm doesn't mean that they're all the same. This particular firm is a bit different. And I can turn that around and get you more candidates. So what you're seeing when you advertise directly may not be exactly what we see in the market. So we tend to see a lot more volume of decent candidates, but still probably only one in every 30 or 40 applications are worthwhile actually interviewing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose because you've just got the volume of jobs that you're trying to fill, you're going to be constantly talking to people, and the time might not be right for them to make the move today, but next year it is. And so there's, I don't know, I would imagine you've got this pool of people that you're in some form of contact with.
And that timing that you mentioned is everything, because when we advertise a job, 9 times out of 10, the candidates that apply don't actually get that job. So you could say, oh, I need a paraplanner, and I'll put an ad for a paraplanner up as soon as you tell me you need one. But I'll go back to the last 3 months worth of paraplanners I interviewed, and I'll call them about the job, organise some interviews. By the time I've actually had applications come in that are half decent for that particular job, I've probably filled it with someone that I met with a few months ago. So we tend to be working backwards a little bit. But then we've built up our portfolio of candidates that are looking right now, and they're red hot, ready to go for when the next paraplanning job gets called in. So they often don't get the job they apply for.
So it's hard work finding advisors. Is it It's hard work for associates.
Associates is a bit easier. It's paraplanners. Paraplanners are the hard work. Yeah. So we've seen a trend over the last 19 years since I've been doing this. We've had paraplanning onshore, and then there's this wave of it's all going offshore, and then a few years later, everyone's sick of it because the quality's not good enough, and they bring it back in, and then they say it's too expensive because when they don't have a lot of reviews, they're paying, you know, 90, 100K for a paraplane, and they're not utilizing, and then it goes back out and back in and back out. And that's been the trend that I've always seen until probably the last 5 years or so. It's not coming back in. Most of the businesses that I'm dealing with don't actually have paraplanners, and that's why there's so many more AA roles available. So the role of an associate advisor back in the day when I was recruiting for them many moons ago was a technical paraplanner that can attend a client meeting, get a feel for the client and write the SOA. That's not what an associate advisor does anymore. Now an associate advisor attends a client meeting typically, might do some file notes, might do some strategy development and send an SOA request to an external paraplanner. The paraplanner actually writes the SOA. So that paraplanning skill set is now sitting in overseas in the Philippines, in Sri Lanka, and the Melbourne-based ones don't want to be employees because they've got all the flexibility in the world to just pick up SOAs here and there when they want to. They don't have to go to an office. They can work it around their families. So paraplanning is incredibly difficult. If a business actually comes to me asking for a paraplanner, it's hard, very hard.
Yeah. And so some people that run kind of paraplanning businesses, onshore paraplanning businesses.
Yeah.
But are you finding are there a lot of solo operators in the paraplanning space, or are they tied with an outsourced group that might be located in Australia?
There's a lot of good outsource groups located in Australia that I've actually referred business to previously. But we do find the odd one or two candidates that may come to me and apply for a role because they went out on their own when they left their employer in New South Wales and moved to Melbourne, and they still do the outsourced paraplanning. But then it's not enough. Working for one business as a paraplanner is often not enough. Yeah. And they're trying to tap into these outsourced paraplanning businesses or calling me up and asking me if I know any businesses that would be able to take them on, even if it's just a day or two a week or the odd one or two SOAs a week. It's very hard to make ends meet if you're just doing paraplanning by yourself without a group. To actually, then you become a networker where you're trying to network with financial planning businesses to ask them for work. It's not typically a paraplanning skill set. So it's very difficult for them to go out and do that.
Yeah. Have you found over the years that many of them have transitioned into like a typical associate advisor role now, or are they just a different type of person that doesn't make that fit?
Little bit of both. The more mature, the people that got into paraplanning before the Royal Commission would have been more inclined to do paraplanning, associate advisor and work their way up. But post Royal Commission, they're not interested in doing paraplanning. It's straight to associates, or they're paraplanners that want to be in the back office, and they just want to do the technical work. But one of the other things that we should mention that's been a drastic impact on our industry was all the remediation roles. Where did all the paraplanners go? I was recruiting paraplanning roles, you know, for someone with 18 months or so experience at 75K back in the day, in say 2019, when that was a really good salary. And then they'd get offered a job doing remediation at 95. And of course they just jumped.
Yeah.
And that took away an awful lot of the paraplanning skill set that we had, because they were the majority of people taking these remediation roles, or retiring advisors. They didn't want to keep their licenses anymore. And they all came back, you know, back to trying to get jobs in the industry once all the remediation was over with, and really struggled because, you know, their skill set wasn't as up to date or as relevant. They would say it is because they looked at SOAs every day of the week and told people what they were doing wrong, but they hadn't been doing the modelling on Xplan and actually writing the SOAs for some time. So that was a real challenge too.
I was going to ask if did those people come back into a First Financial type business as a paraplanner, or did we lose them completely from?
I think we lost them. We lost the majority of them, because there aren't so many paraplanning roles available anymore. So they had to go and do different things. And also their expectations in terms of salary was through the roof.
I was going to say, I can remember back when that was all going on, we lost some people in our paraplaning team. And there was one girl that got from our client servants team. She'd gone into paraplaning and then she was there for a while. And then she got a contract job with one of them doing remediation. Mm. And like her salary was higher than what we were paying some of the advisors at that stage. And like, well, she's in her early 20s. Like, she'd be silly not to go and do that and take the money whilst it's on offer.
But if you put that money away and realise that you're going to be taking like a 30% pay cut when that period is over, that's great. But we all know that most of us just live within our means, right? And then you've got to suffer a huge pay cut when you've got a mortgage.
Yeah, and I think that would have been the sticking point for a lot of people to say, you mean I have to go back and do the job that I was doing, I have to take a 30% pay cut.
Yeah. It was a very hard reality, unfortunately.
So what about the client services type role? What's life like in that space?
Oh, there is such a desire for career CSOs. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So if I find a fabulous career CSO that says to me, I don't want to be a paraplanner, I don't want to be an associate, I'm just perfectly happy being the backbone to this particular advisor or supporting a number of advisors, even if I don't have a job available, I can send an email to my top 10 clients and say, hey, I've got a great career CSO, anybody interested? And I'll get them a few interviews and someone will snap them up. Because they're so hard to come by. Everybody wants to be applying for this job because they want the next one. But if you actually find someone that just genuinely enjoys that job and they're very, very good at it, there's always a home for them. And the unfair thing is that, yes, you should get paid more if you've been doing the job longer and you're more qualified. But even if you have the same experience as someone, like you've got 2-3 years experience as a CSO and you want to stay in that role, versus you've got 2 or 3 years experience as a CSO, but you want to be an associate, the career CSO will get paid more.
Yeah.
Because businesses are prepared to pay for that consistency and for the lack of pressure to have to promote in order to retain. So they'll pay a premium.
What are businesses paying as a ballpark for that type
anything,
of person?
It's anybody with 12 months experience as a CSO, degree qualified, 12 months in a decent business could be looking at anything from a bare minimum of 65 plus super. And then your career CSOs are absolutely fabulous. I don't want to get anybody too excited when I say this, but last year I did place a number of them on 90 plus super and one on 95 plus super.
Yeah.
Now, it's hard to get. That's not a reality for the vast majority. But I would say that about 80K plus super for 3 years plus CSO experience, if you want to stay in a CSO role, is very achievable.
Yeah. And you've got to look at it from that. Like you hear numbers like that, okay, that's a lot of money, you know. But then when you think about it from a business perspective, particularly if you don't have a big pool of client services where you can somewhat deal with people coming and going.
Yes.
But if you're a smaller business where you have one or two people there, that's a big downtime. If one of your client service people leaves because they get promoted or they go somewhere else, and then you've got this gap of, okay, I need to hire someone, I need to train someone, it's going to take them a while to get up and running. Like you're going to burn thousands of dollars in time and effort.
Yep.
Versus you could have just paid someone what sounds like a big salary for a particular role, but you pay someone and then they're hopefully there for the long term.
The best thing that a business can do is focus on retention. And I know that's terrible for my career, but giving that advice to businesses that know me really well and trust me, they will often come to me. I mean, Joe Akiki, he's a good one. He'll come to me every now and then and he'll be like, Kira, what do I need to be paying so-and-so? You know, I've got to do a pay review. And what do you think about this? And, good businesses actually care about paying the right amount for their staff and will actually come to you and say, what should I be paying? And I'll tell them, you're a little bit unders on this one or I'd be a bit concerned about you losing this one. And you'll go, right, great, okay, I'm going to up their salary. That's what I'm going to do. And, you know, be smart. You could pay your CSOs an extra $5,000 a year and it will save you a $15,000 recruitment fee and an extra $10,000 that you're going to have to pay the next one. Be smart about it. Retain them and pay them what they're worth in the market. And often businesses will say to me, my CSO left, but they were just asking for so much money. I just didn't think they were worth it. I say, I use this, it's maybe silly. I'll say, they're worth what the market's prepared to pay. It's like you saying that your house is worth $1 million. Well, when you go to auction, if someone pays 1.1, that's what it was worth. If someone pays 900 and that's the top bidder, then that's what the house was worth. And it's the exact same for candidates. They're worth what the market is prepared to pay. And if they can go out and get a job tomorrow paying an extra $10,000, then that's what their value in the market is.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, how do you retain the good people? Like, you know, clearly you pay them appropriately and so forth. But do you see businesses doing any more than just paying them what they're worth?
Flexibility. Yeah, everybody wants flexibility. It's the number one thing. So I did about how many interviews did I did three interviews today, and all three candidates said, I would move for the same money if I was able to work from home 2 days a week. Yeah, I'd love to get a pay increase, but it's not as important to me as the opportunity to work from home 2 days a week, to skip the 45 minutes to hours commute. And one of the candidates I interviewed today, she lives in South Melbourne. I said, God, you're not commuting very far, you know, you're going to the CBD. Well, I've got a dog and I wouldn't mind not having him locked up in the apartment all day. And for my lunch break, I'd like to go for a walk around the park with my dog instead of a walk around the city. Is that too much to ask for? Some employers would think that that is ridiculous. And some employers will embrace that and say, as long as the job gets done, who cares? Doesn't matter where you're doing it from.
You get a sense of what businesses are doing in terms of that working from home, working from the office, halfway in between. Like, do you have an idea where that's heading or what's going on out there?
And I don't think it's as clear as everyone's trying to get people back into the office, but I do see a lot of that. There's a lot of businesses that are trying to get people back in the office 4 or 5 days a week. Yeah. But then there's a lot of businesses that just know that they will lose staff if they change things. So they're keeping it at 2 days a week from home. There's a beautiful business in the CBD that I was recruiting for 12 months ago, and they were looking for an associate. I kept coming up with these great candidates, but everybody wanted to work from home 2 days a week. And it was a year ago, and people are a little bit more inclined to come in now. And in the end, I said to this, I've recruited everyone in this business. There's 10 staff in there, and I've got a great relationship with the manager. And I said, Rob, if you change this to 2 days a week, this job will be easy to fill. But I've been working on it for 4 weeks now, and it's the definition of insanity, because every time I get you a good candidate, they get three other interviews for three other jobs. They love yours, but the other businesses are offering them 2 days a week from home. So he said, leave it with me, I'll get back to you. He called me back an hour later and he said, Kira, we now close the office on a Tuesday and a Thursday. They're the days that everybody works from home and we only do client meetings, you know, on the other 3 days. I was like, great. If I hadn't filled that job within a couple of days, I would have looked like a fool. So luckily I did, and it was so much easier. So some businesses are embracing it and they're listening to their staff. And some businesses are really putting the pressure on for people to come back in.
Yeah, see, I get that sense. You know, I talk to different people that as you said, people are leaving because they want the flexibility. I said someone on the podcast that lives a long way from Melbourne, and he said, I'm sick of going backwards and forwards, and he's working for a financial advice business that's in Queensland, and so it's 100% from home. And I think, employers that, whichever way the businesses decide to go, are we all from the office, are we part from home?
Yep.
You're going to need to appreciate that you may lose some people if you're pushing all the way to the office because there are other options out there.
Yep. Regional Queensland business called me last week and said, look, we need a CSO. We've tried really hard. We can't find anybody in the area. We're now starting to think, well, if we've had CSOs in the Philippines, why can't we have a CSO in Melbourne? But maybe someone with a lot more experience. So they engaged me to find someone for them 100% remotely. And then some businesses just never let their, even during COVID, they made excuses to have their staff in 5 days a week. Yeah. And they've never faltered from that. And that's it, 5 days a week. They wouldn't even comprehend someone working from home a day a week.
Yeah, I suppose just different ways of running businesses and you'll make your own decision on how you want to run it. And
if it works,
then you'll staff it accordingly, I guess.
Yeah, if it works for them, great, but they will find it harder to find staff.
Yeah. So what about the other side of things? You know, we're talking about employers trying to find staff in different roles and so forth. What about the other side of it, that I've got a job, I'm working in a business, how do I make myself attractive to other employers? If I'm not getting the opportunities where I currently am, how can I make myself attractive to someone that might be hiring for that next job that I'm looking for?
Can I tell you the most basic of mistakes that we see? spelling errors on your resume, forgetting to put capitals at the beginning of your sentences, and misspelling my role, R-O-L-L, was to, you know, things like that are pretty, you know, we see that a lot. And you are not making yourself very attractive to other employers if you've got spelling and grammatical issues on your resume. So that's often a problem that we're seeing firstly. But it's not as hard on the candidate side as it is on the employer side. It's a candidate-driven market at the moment. There's candidates out there that could easily, I could get one decent candidate, three or four good job offers in 1 week. It's not that difficult for them. You know, don't forget to dress appropriately for an interview. We've all become very, very relaxed post-COVID with being able to work from home and doing a lot of Zoom meetings and Teams, and that sometimes if I'm not smart enough to think, I need to make sure this person knows to wear a suit to the interview, because sometimes I won't tell them because I assume a certain level of intelligence. And then candidates will turn up just looking really casual for an interview, and it may be a particularly senior role, and they've just lost all credibility straight away. So, you know, don't forget, yes, we are post-COVID and the world is a little bit more relaxed, but, you know, first impressions count. Don't apply for every single job that a recruiter is advertising. I may have 15 to 20 jobs on seek on any given day. And if you apply for every single one of them, it just makes it look a little bit silly, and I don't know what you actually want. So that can be quite confusing as well. But it's certainly not as hard for candidates to get jobs as it is for the employers to find the right people.
Because that applying for multiple jobs example there.
Oh, they'll apply for a CSO, a paraplanner, and a senior advisor role.
Yeah. I'm just going to apply for one job with you and then hopefully get a chance to speak with you, and then you'll help me work out which of the 15 jobs that you're trying to fill I might be best put forward for.
Yeah, and a lot of people do that. And that's the benefit of having so many different jobs available, that I do get lovely phone calls from candidates that say, Kira, I just wanted to call you because I've seen that you've got so many different roles available. This is my experience. You know, do you think you could help me? And I'll say, great, let's have a Teams chat. Let's figure out what suits you the best. And then, you know, could be that we represent you for three different roles, but it may be that none of them are right for you at the moment, and we'll keep you in mind for the next one. But that scattergun approach of applying for every single job, so it wouldn't be the best way to do things.
I suppose there's people, you know, some of the younger ones have just come out of uni and they're doing, you know, client service type roles and whatever, they will have never even thought about this kind of stuff that we're talking about. After you've been in it for a while and you might have moved a few jobs, you get a sense of what you need to do and what you don't need to do. But
when you're new
and you don't know any different, unless your parents maybe tell you what you should do and how you should dress.
What about career advisors at university? Do they not help them? Do they not point them in the right direction?
I can't remember her name, but my first job out of uni, I had a job working at Mercer, and then I was trying to get other jobs. And it wasn't until I sat down with a recruiter and she said to me, well, what studying have you done since you finished university? Like, you've got a commerce degree. And I no one had ever said to me I needed to do any other study than do my commerce degree at uni. I had no idea that this whole other world of studying existed. It wasn't until the recruiter told me, I need to go and do something else. Went and did some studying and ended up with other jobs. But
a lot of the time our jobs as recruiters are to give people ideas and coach them. We, you know, I fill about 65 roles every financial year. Now, I would interview at least 10 candidates every week, sometimes 15. Sometimes I'll have a slow week because I'm busy with other things. And so we don't place all the candidates that we meet. And sometimes their applications aren't great. And we just spend the time talking to them saying, look, I can't get you your first job in financial planning because businesses don't often like to pay recruiters for someone with no experience. So we get a lot of graduates approaching us, and we're kind to them, and we always give them the time of day and say, look, we can't help you with your first job, but here's some pointers on your resume. You know, put some hobbies on there, put some social. You talked to me about the fact that you're a captain of a football team. Put that on there. People like that you're sociable and you're sporty and you're into leadership. And, you know, so put these things on your resume. Don't forget to put these dates that you worked in this supermarket and do this and do that. apply to businesses directly. You know, oh, you live in Blackburn. Do you know how many financial planning businesses are within 5Ks of Blackburn? Go Google, go and send your resume to them directly, you know, and you'd be amazed at how many people come back years later saying, Kira, you gave me this great advice a few years ago, and now I'm an associate advisor and I want you to help me get the next job. And so we do spend a lot of time guiding people, but there's only so much that we can do for really junior candidates, unfortunately.
Yep. I've had a couple of chats with people in different businesses, you know, well-established businesses, they're kind of owners and managers running businesses, try to find senior advisors to come in. And they all talk about, we struggle to find the right fit person. Do you get a sense of if it's like, if that's a different, so they're businesses where there's existing clients, there's new client inquiries coming through.
Yep.
Like they're not looking for someone to bring a whole lot of clients with them. They're saying,
yeah,
we need someone to fill the spot and we're going to support you with all of these, you know, associate advisors or whatever it might be.
But they can't find
finding a person to find that spot seems difficult.
Some businesses are extremely fussy, and I'm not saying that that's wrong at all, because I think that we want to get it right. Us recruiters don't want to be working for 50% of our fee. We don't want to fill the job and then have to refill it a few months later because we got it wrong. We want to do it properly. And so we appreciate if a business doesn't take someone that they're only 50% sure of, or even 90% sure of, because we don't want to do the work again. We want to get it right. But yes, sometimes the criteria that we get is ridiculous. And we get a lot of, he's too similar to this other person that we've got. And the problem that we've got with this other person is this. Four or five rounds of interviews. There's a particular business that I'm thinking of that puts people through five rounds of interviews. And in total, when my candidate went through the process with them, she'd probably spent maybe 10 to 12 hours with this business before getting the job offer. Now, imagine if she hadn't got that job offer, all the time that was invested in that just to not get it. And obviously that does happen to a lot of people that apply for that job. Businesses are very, very fussy. But yes, it is a struggle to find a certain type of advisor. And I think that Australia, we can potentially be a little bit narrow-minded. We tend to like a certain style. We tend to want people that mirror us. And we don't want someone too different. And that can be a bit of a problem as well.
Yeah. We want all the advisors and the associates and everyone to kind of look and act the same, don't we, rather than...
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That is exactly right. There's not as much diversity as there should be in the industry.
Has it ever not been you referred it to the candidate market before. Has it ever not been a candidate market, or is it just, it's either more or less of candidate market?
No, I remember a time when it was an employer market. Now, showing my age.
She didn't.
But no, I do remember the time, where we were saying sorry to candidates, you know, sorry.
Jobs.
Yeah. And they were calling us pretty desperate. Have you got any contract jobs? Have you got any temp jobs? There just wasn't enough jobs around. But that was a very long time ago. But yeah, for an extremely long time, it has been a candidate-driven market. Candidates are dictating terms, because if you can find a good one, you'll bend over backwards to accommodate them. And I'm not sure if it's right or wrong, but it's what tends to happen.
Yeah, I suppose it's just a sign of where we're at. You know, there's been thousands of advisors have left the industry, so there's probably knock-on effects for support staff and everyone else.
Absolutely. But
there's aging population, people transitioning to retirement, so you've got increasing demand, decreasing supply, and you kind of got economics crossover. And
I'll often say to a business, I'm representing this candidate, whatever they're 100K plus super, whatever the job is, whatever the candidate, they're asking for 100K plus super. Please note, that's what they're asking for today. Now, if this person goes out and does three other interviews as well as yours, and they're offered 110 plus super at three other businesses, do not be surprised if I come back to you and ask for an extra $10,000. So I'm saying to you that today they're asking for 100, but I don't like it when at the last minute candidates ask me for more, because I'll say, I represented you at 100. You told me you would take 100. You told me you were happy with 100. And now I'm embarrassed going back to my businesses and asking for more money, and everything's blame the recruiter. The recruiter wants to make more money. So I will have to now say, this candidate's going to be very popular. He or she has three other interviews. If they offer her more money, you're going to need to be prepared to pay more. Or we walk away, that's fine. But I'm just raising it with you that it may happen.
Yep.
That's a candidate market.
Kira, thanks for joining me this afternoon. For anyone that wants to reach out to you and find you, where's best to find you?
kbrown@fsrecruit.com.au.
Thanks for joining me.
Awesome. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, James. Have a great day.